Welcome to the Spy Who Raised Me podcast. Conversations between a daughter and her father. Yes, you've guessed it, he was a spy.
My name's Jane Craigie, and I'm here with my dad, Ian Craigie. We're recording this on Zoom in another wave of the COVID roller coaster, or Corona coaster, as people call it. How are you, Dad?
Yeah, I'm good, Jane. It's Corona. I haven't heard that term, Corona.
Coaster.
Coaster. No, that's a good one. That must be Scottish, is it?
I don't know. Anyway. It's the ups and downs of this blessed virus.
I know. It's bad news, isn't it?
It is bad news.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway, so today we are going to, we haven't done a podcast for a while. Not really sure why. We've both been busy. But today we are going to go back in time to the place where Dad spent his childhood. So it's a little village on the Murray Firth called Kingston on Spey, and it's right at the mouth of the Spey, as the name suggests. And Dad, tell us a little bit about the village.
Yeah, the village is, the older I get, the more I look back and think of the village in different ways. I think that's human nature, isn't it? You know, as you go through the years, I'm getting on a bit now, and you're looking back to when, the 40s and the 50s, so a lot has changed since then. But when you look back, it's I think it was such a privileged upbringing, you know, in a small village like that. And way back in 17, just to give you some idea of the history of the village, way back in 1783, a long time ago, two enterprising men from Hull in England decided that they wanted to build ships in Kingston. Now, Kingston was a small village, probably 50 houses or thereabouts. And these men contacted the Duke of Gordon, who had advertised the sale of timber and the amount of timber was absolutely exceptional. It was forest, really, of best pine wood. And these two men thought, this looks interesting. If we could get the wood Kingston, and we could set up a shipbuilding enterprise in Kingston, wouldn't that be a nice thing to do? So that's what they did. They bought the land from the Duke of Gordon for £10,000, and they came to Kingston. And over a period of years, they created a shipyard, and they created living places for the people who came and worked. So that is the introduction. So Kingston, yes, as Jane said, is in a lovely position. It's on the Murray Firth. It has the Spey flowing into the east of the village, and it has a large shingle beach that you can see from the village. And it has the most gorgeous sea you ever saw. It's just so beautiful. And the nature, going back to the 1940s, 1950s, was unbelievable. It was sort of unchanged. It was the bay, the Murray Firth, was full of fish, different types of fish, and we'll touch that probably in a later podcast. But it was just teeming with nature. And because it was such a sparsely populated area, it was virtually unchanged, I guess, for 200 or 300 years.
One thing that we probably didn't describe particularly well is that for listeners elsewhere in the world, Kingston on Spey and the River Spey is in the northeast of Scotland, and it is it's a beautiful part, a beautiful area which is known for fishing, for agriculture, and for oil and gas. Dominantly now, isn't it?
Yes.
But it's always been a fishing and farming area, hasn't it? And a big malt whiskey area as well.
Yes, yes. And I mean, it has that variety of things going on. And it's reflected in the people, I think, because they're a very versatile population who have loads of skills. One wouldn't have thought that, you know, a small village like Kingston, and it has a neighboring village, a twin village called Garmouth, which is about a mile from Kingston. And you would never have realized that the variety of skills and the attitude of the people who lived in that area was equal to none. I mean, they were just incredible how they could do things and how they could change doing things, and that it was remarkable. But anyway, getting back to the village itself, and as I said earlier, we'll do a podcast on how the fishing boat industry and the clippers, they manufactured a variety of different types of ship. But the village itself had a unique setting, as I said earlier, quite close to the estuary of the Spey, which on a regular basis migrated westwards, and every probably 30 years a new estuary had to be dug. So there was this sort of ever-changing scenario of river changing its direction, its estuary, and the Murray Firth, which, you know, to visit the Murray Firth on a calm summer's day with lazy waves slapping on the shingle beach and the sandy beach, because it's a mixture of sand and shingle, was just incredible. So peaceful, and also with the noise, the roar of the Spey, which is quite a turbulent river, it was just amazing. But it had another side, and during times when the tides were particularly high, if that was coupled with a storm coming off the sea, then Kingston looked very different indeed. Huge waves coming pounding in, and gales disrupting many of the houses in Kingston. And I think that even as recently as a few weeks ago, one such storm occurred when so many trees were blown down, and at the back of Kingston, which is probably 60, 70 meters from the sea and from the estuary of the Spey, the sea burst through the shingle and finished up probably 30 meters from the back of the house, the last row of houses in Kingston. So you have this kind of combination of serenity and nature and so on, but you also have this frequent storms coming in from the North Sea. So in that vein, the sea and the river probably contributed more to the atmosphere of the village. The fish that were around in those days, probably in the 50s and the 60s, was just, again, unbelievable. The salmon used to come in. They were in the autumn, but herring and saithe and sea trout and finnicks and brown trout. I mean, they just abounded. And it was no lie to say that the amount of fish coming, especially into the Spey, was remarkable. And way back in the 1700s, they had started farming the fish. So there were hundreds upon hundreds of people who lived in the village and neighboring area, Garmouth, Kingston mainly. They had boats that used to work on the estuary of the Spey and further up, but mainly the estuary, netting salmon. And the number of salmon, the weight of salmon that they took out of the Spey was, you just can't believe it. And they had to think then of building ways or finding ways of preserving the salmon when they had been caught, because there were so many salmon, there were tons and tons of fish. So what they did was they built an ice house, or a number of ice houses, and during the winter they filled the ice houses full of snow and ice, and all the salmon were placed in those, and like a huge freezer. They lasted right through the year to the following autumn. So that, all of that is part of the structure of the area. Have you seen that, Jane? Have you seen the ice house? And
all the way. I haven't seen the one in Kingston, but all the way along this northeast coast, any big property had an ice house. So it was dug deep into a bank usually. And stone, and they would just, exactly what you said, that they would put snow into it. But the other thing that I heard, I think up at Duff House in Banff, they also used to import timber and other goods, and they used to take blocks of ice from Canada and places like that on these ships, and they would use that in the ice houses.
Really? I didn't realize that. Well, that's something else, isn't it? Imagine, transporting
hauling ice.
Yes, for heaven's sake. But yeah, so that was broadly speaking the village, and over a period of tens of years, they continued with that until, I suppose, within the last 40 years, people have become sensitive to the fact that so many fish were being taken out of the Spey, and they've now curtailed the amounts of fish that can be taken. And I think the nets in most areas, there's probably a couple of estuaries where they still fish with nets, but certainly at Kingston in Spey, it's no longer allowed.
No, apparently on some of the rivers, and probably the Spey's included, but I certainly know the Dee and the Don, which are further south in Aberdeenshire, the local fishing trusts have bought the rights for netting at the mouth of the river, so that they can, and they've employed scientists to look at why the fish stocks are going down so dramatically. Because there's a real problem in all of these rivers in the northeast of Scotland now in terms of salmon and also sea trout numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
So those days you talk about, we've never seen, certainly I've been living up here for nearly 20 years, and I've never seen volumes of fish anywhere near what you're describing.
No, I mean, because we lived in the village, we had free permits. So all the inhabitants of Kingston and Garmouth, the twin village, could fish for free. And that was all the way along the beach. And Lossiemouth was the next town west of Kingston, which was 4 miles away. So we could fish all that beach. And also, I think it was the first four pools in the Spey because it was quite big business further up the Spey towards Aberlour, where you know, it was very expensive for people to get permission to fish on and film. But way back in the 50s, I guess, when we were fishing, I mean, we all had salmon rods and sea rods and spent half our time fishing. And they had the variety of fish was just remarkable. I can recall some lovely memories of fishing one of the pools, a golf course pool, which is a good place for catching sea trout. And we used to go across to the a golf course pool, and we would start fishing up 9 o'clock in the evening. And then it as it grew dark, the sea trout came. Sea trout are notorious for jumping high when they've taken the fly, because it's always fly we use. And you would, in the darkness, you'd be fishing away, all of a sudden you'd hear this splash. And a few seconds later, the sea trout landing in the water, you know. And it was happening. We could fish and get half a dozen sea trout of a night, and then go back in the morning and fry them up.
That time of year, you know, if you were fishing in the, well, presumably in through the spring, the daylight would still have been, certainly as you got into April, May and June, the days are incredibly long up here in the northeast of Scotland, aren't they?
Yes, that's a good point. So you could, I mean, you had much longer hours of daylight, as you say, compared with the south. But yeah, so that was good. And before I start describing Kingston, one of the, as a child, you know, having spent, I was 15 years in Kingston, one of the great attractions was the burn, the stream that flowed through the village. I mean, you can imagine with all the young kids, no screens, no television. We used to congregate in the morning and just play in the barn, go across to the Spey or on the beach, and we had so much to do there. And I mean, the nature, when I think of it, the barn was full of all sorts of creatures, and it is to my regret, I think about it a lot. We all had .177 rifles in those days to hunt rabbits, but we also had what we thought were rats in the barn, and we would do, that was one of the sports. We would say, "Oh, come on, we'll shoot a few rats in the barn." Of course, in later years, we realized they were water voles. So I think they're still there today. When you look back and think, I wish we'd know. But yes, so coming into the village, Jane, you'll recall it, on the left, the first road as you came into the village was Lean Road. And Lean Road was where we lived, but it's where I was brought up. And it just happened to have been built by one of the two men who had come from Hull 100 years prior to that. And they had built probably three houses of some substance. They lived in them, and they were built of granite, and they were three stories high. So in a village that had one-story cottages, and they sort of stood out. But the great joy of having a barn at the bottom of the garden was just incredible. So yeah, so that was part of it. And the hinterland, I mean, the there's a lot of farms around Kingston, because the occupations were either farming or working in the Varsity Commission or working in places like Bucky and Banff where fishing boats were built. So there were a lot of very skilled artisans in Kingston who basically spent their life building boats in Bucky, seagoing fishing boats. So, I mean, that was all part of it. But the hinterland to the north was, or to the west and the south, rather, was either farming or just swampy land with reeds and full of wildlife. With on the banks, there were farms in very sandy land, but the amount of and variety of wildlife there was just incredible, because they had so many different types of land they could breed in. I mean, I can remember snipe every autumn. Or before that, you'd hear the snipe, male snipe, coming, diving down to impress the female. On the beach and further west, there were a variety of different seabirds who nested in the, either in the trees or on the stony beach. And, I mean, a serious amount. You could walk up there, and we used to pinch the odd egg, especially from the herring gulls, and eat them raw, it was going. But there were terns, there were herring gulls, petrels, there were all the ground nesting birds. And when you walked through that on the way to Lossie Mow, they would attack you, and especially the terns. So you had to be very nimble-footed to get through that. But at the back of that, there was a Forestry Commission plantation, which we used to work in as a student. That was full of different species like woodcock, and further up the hill there were corncrakes, which you don't hear now here. You have to go to US or some of the islands to hear them. But I mean, in those days, corncrakes were everywhere. You know, they were in the barley fields and the corn fields. You never saw them, but you could hear them. And they would be, throughout the breeding season, they'd be calling and calling and calling. And the gorgeous bird. I think I only ever saw one a couple of times. But can you remember these, Jen? Corncrake.
No, I've never seen corncrakes, Dad. I know there's been some reintroduction projects or encouraging corncrakes on some of the islands, like you say, Skye and places like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're quite a rare sight now, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
But that whole, the whole of the northeast of Scotland, sorry to interrupt you,
yes.
We are so lucky that it's the migratory route for so many different birds, isn't it? And I wonder, yes. Dad, you've always been passionate about bird life in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that interest came from being brought up as a young boy? And you talk about it very fondly, that you used to spend many, 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 many hours walking around Kingston, the sand dunes, and, you know, the whole of that landscape and that seascape, watching birds.
Mm. Watching birds and listening to birds, which is another facet of you know, observing wildlife. Yeah, in fact, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, who was brought up in that area, and I was saying, "Do you remember stickleback?" And he said, "Vaguely." And as you come into Kingston from Garmouth on the right hand side, there are tall beds of reeds, because of the fact that it's so close to the fresh water in the Spey, and the silt that was created with other streams flowing into that, it was an ideal place for reeds to grow. So we had reeds probably 6 feet high, you can imagine the wealth of wildlife there. And one of my loves was to crawl into these reeds, and the water was quite clear and probably foot, maybe 2 feet deep, and it was also secret because you could crawl into the reeds. No one knew you were there, and you were at one with nature. And the stickleback were fascinating little things. They're only about, what, 3 inches long, and they had colonized the reed bed. And because it was brackish water, some fresh water from the Spey, but also some coming in from the sea, it was an ideal habitat for the stickleback. And the male stickleback, bossy little things that they were, had a deep red chest to chase away, I suppose, would-be predator. And the female stickleback, all she did was the big job. She laid eggs on the bottom of the pool. And then the male stickleback would look after the eggs. It would chase away any marauders, would be marauder. It would fan the eggs to give them plenty of oxygen. So I used to lie there, look at this little fish, fanning its fins above the eggs. And you could see little ruffles of sand coming up as it did that. But I think, and similar things, you know, little cameos of nature that you would see in a variety of different ways, you know. So we used to spend hours and hours not stealing eggs from some of the birds that were nesting in the area, but just watching them and trying to get some idea of what their habits were, what fed on, you know, things like that. And over a period, I think it got seared on your mind. Set, and I think ever since, because of that background, I have a great affinity with nature, and it's if anything, as one gets older, it becomes more poignant than when you're young. Because I think when you're young, you're not aware of perhaps the dangers for birds and fish and so on to breed successfully. So yeah, so that is a great part of my life now, doing that. Jenny, you're very fond of that too.
I am. I think having one of your parents who's passionate about it and always notices it, and I think one of the things that I see in you, which, you know, when you live in the countryside, it is easier to do, but a lot of people did it during the pandemic because everything quietened down, and that is to understand the rhythms of nature and of seasons. So often people, you know, go through their lives at 100 miles an hour, and if you're living in a city, you don't see the sky as well, and you can't appreciate all of the things that you grew up with. But that is one of the things that I've learned from you, is to appreciate those rhythms of nature, mm-hmm. and to try and take some time to notice them, because you can feel and see so much if you enliven your senses to it. You can feel a cold front coming in. Every morning when you wake up, you can sense a difference in the day, and it can be, you know, it can be all sorts of factors that change a day from one day to the other. But to notice those things is so important, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And another thing that people don't do so much in this modern world is listen. You know, there's so much to be learned through listening to wildlife, to birds singing, to you know, the different habits that they have, and the different seasons. You know, the noise that trees make when it's windy and things like that. I think if this project that we have with allotments and nature, I think one of the great things about doing something like that is getting children in particular to listen and just sometimes just slow down, sit down or lie down in a field and just listen. And you can pick up so much and you feel part of the extended family, you can say, with nature. Because they, over a period, they'll accept your presence to some extent. I mean, they're always nervous because, human beings are not good news as far as nature is concerned. But and it's interesting to see that. And going back to Kingston, the nature and the complexity of it, diversity of it too, you learned such a lot about what now we complain about, eels coming up in their hundreds, coming up the burn in the village, and they would make their way up to the swamps and that further away from the village. The water voles, there were little brown trout, and it was all part of the excitement of life, see things like that, and to run home and tell somebody that I've seen this and I've seen that. Very exciting.
And Dad,
so yeah,
I was going to also ask you about we're talking about the past and observations about the past. And one of the things I can always remember about Kingston is the richness of people and also commerce. Even in a tiny little village like that, even, in my lifetime, I can remember three shops in that village. And now you go to Kingston,
yes,
there are no shops.
Yes.
It's changed a lot, hasn't it?
Remarkably. And your timing there was just perfect, Jane, because I spoke to my sister, your auntie, in Florida. She lives in Florida. Yesterday, I think I mentioned to you, I didn't say I had spoken to her. So we're chatting away, and I was saying, do you remember the barn, Lynn? She said, yeah, I remember the barn. She's 11 years younger than I am. I remember that. And what about the eels? Yeah, I remember the eel. And what about Kylie? And there was a pause, and she said, the shop. I said, yes, the shop. And if anything epitomizes, a village like Kingston, it was the shop, because they were different. There were three shops at one stage. But Kylie was the first shop as you entered the village on the left. And he was a dear old chap. We called him Kylie because he originally came Kyle of Locha. And you could write a book about Kylie. He was such an offensive man. He ran a shop, and your auntie, Lynn, that we were talking to yesterday, she was falling off her chair laughing because I was saying, you remember Kyle? Oh, yes, I remember Kyle. And I said, do you remember his wooden leg? I said, I remember his wooden leg. And what about the shop? She said, yeah, I remember the shop. Yeah, I can remember he had cheese on the counter under a gauze frame thing. And she said it used to be the same lump of cheese after a few weeks, and he would still lift up this gauze cage and hack off a piece of cheese if you wanted it to. But he was an incredible man. He kept a cow, which he kept it must have been about half a mile from the village. And my early memories of Kyle going up the burnside very slowly with his wooden leg, and he would walk all the way up to where he kept his cow. And it would take him, you know, half an hour to get up there. And he would get a hold of his cow and put a rope around its neck, and then he'd walk all the way back to his place in the village. And he had a byre at the bottom of his garden in the, where the shop was. And he would get the cow in, and he would milk it by hand. And I can always remember, it's a fond memory I have. He would sit on a stool. You can imagine him sitting down to milk a cow. His left leg, which is a wooden leg, would be splayed out underneath the cow's belly to the left. And he wore a cap with a brim, you know, the old fashioned. That would be turned round so that he could place his head on the cow's side and not disturb it too much with a hard brim. And he would just sit there and you'd hear the ch-ch-ch-ch as he milked the cow. And then, having done that, he would fill up all the cans that we in the village had left on his doorstep. They were tin cans with a lid that fitted quite snugly. So if he needed milk, he would put the clean can on his doorstep the night before, and then he would fill up whatever cans were there. And so then 7 o'clock in the morning or something, parents would say, go and get the milk. So you'd sprint down the main street and get this thing of milk and bring it back. But the thing about Kyle was he never complained. He was such a gentleman. And his living conditions were, they were not hygienic. And he would sit, some of us used to go and keep him company of an evening. And he had a tin plate, that was all, tin plate, no other plate. He had a knife which he sharpened from time to time, and it was pointed because there was so little metal left on it that you can imagine a handle and a little diamond, a little triangle of metal. But he used to sit there and he would have a bit of loaf, cheese, maybe an onion. And he would just sit there and cut away at this and eat it. And on more than one occasion, a rat would pop up on his table. And he never used to do anything. He would just sit and watch this rat and get on with his food. And eventually the rat would disappear. But on one occasion, his grandson was staying for the weekend. And he was in a cart in one of the lower floor room, and there was a scream in the middle of the night. And Kylie said, "I didn't know what was happening." He said, and of course he slept upstairs with his wooden leg, by his bedside. He had to try and get downstairs, or either that or spend 5 minutes putting his wooden leg. But the little boy had been bitten by a rat on his forehead. And I was talking to you, Jane, saying I must try and contact Kylie's grandson, who lives in Kingston now. But I haven't succeeded yet, but I will, just to see what he remembers of that time.
Well, maybe if he's listening to this, he can get in touch.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was all, but his shop was full. I was saying to Lynn, to exercise her memory, I was saying, well, can you remember what he had in the shop? And she said, he had boot polish, yeah. He had round trees, fruit gums, which he chewed himself sometimes, and he had to push his false teeth back in when they're empty. So he had that. He had cheese. He had matches. He had fly, you know, the fly catchers, the ones that you unroll or pull out, in all of these things. And the doorbell on his shop had one of these sprung, you know, the old fashioned Victorian springs with a bell on the end. So he had that, but, it was surprising how many things, Lynn could remember. So I said, write down anything that you recall, you know, because he was such an interesting old man.
But those days, you know, we always see in our lifetimes things going back to where they came. And now as we face climate change and all of us having to change our habits and be very conscious about what we do and what we waste and what we don't waste, you know, buying local has become a big part of our lives now.
Yeah.
And back, you know, what you're describing there is, although it may not have been the most hygienic shop, but that was the way of things back then. We didn't have the health and safety regulations that we do now. But most importantly, that little shop was a lifeline for all of the families that lived in the village.
Yes.
You relied on him, and he would stock anything you needed. I know you told me a story once that he used to stock shoes and socks and all of those sorts of things that little corner stores used to stock.
Yeah. And Lynn recalled an incident where my mother and her mother, Sissy, said she suffered from dementia, and she'd said to Lynn, I need a nightdress. And I saw one in Kylie's shop. It was folded up on one of the shelves, you see. So she said, would you go down and get it? I want to buy the nightdress. So off she went, and she said, I can remember quite clearly, bell goes and Kylie's tap, tap, tapping of his wooden leg from his kitchen at the back. And she said, I stood there and when he arrived at the counter, I said, oh, my mother wants to buy the nightdress. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. He said, it's too late. He said, I had to use it on my beehives up in the field, keep them warm in the winter. So she didn't get it.
It was probably flannelette as well, wasn't it?
It was probably flannelette, exactly. All interesting.
Well, it's really lovely to reminisce on all of these things, because sharing your memories of that place for anybody who's been there or anybody who's interested in the northeast of Scotland, you know, we should all be doing this, shouldn't we, Dad?
Yeah, of course we should. It's almost therapeutic, isn't it?
Mm.
And you know, I think the number of life is so fast at this point in time. You miss so much of the content of life, you know. And sitting and talking about different things, it reminds you of how things were. Not necessarily in a nostalgic sense, but you know, that's how it was. And to get the feeling of you know, how people lived in those times and how they survived. I mean, it was a question of surviving, I guess, some of the time. I think it's so interesting.
And how do you feel when you think back to those early years?
Well, I was saying to somebody the other day, I feel privileged, of having, you know, lived in a village like that. But of course, at the time that you're there, you're so busy doing things and, you know, fishing or going to school or walking the dog, you know, all of those things are so intense when you're young that it's not until you can unravel some of those memories in later years that you feel the benefit of it, you know. And I think for people who write autobiographies, and I think that's one of the charms of that, you can see into their lives and their and the mind and the memories. And so, and that's a very beautiful thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it is. And if you think back to when you were brought up, you did mention it, there were no screens.
Yeah.
Photographs were a rarity because they were complicated to take and they were expensive to process. And they were just bits of cardboard, ultimately. So, so many families have very few of those precious and particularly everyday memories. And I know we Googled Kylie's shop to try and find a photo of it. And of course, nobody, you know, it'd be very unlikely that anybody ever took a photograph of the inside of that shop.
No, that's right. And you mentioned three shops. The other shop that's worthy of note was the Dunbar's shop, which was on Beach Road, which was, there are three roads in Kingston, Lean Road, Beach Road, and Middle Road, I think. Another one. But anyway, the Dunbar's shop, Beach Road, was better stock, one has to say, than Kylie. She used to, Miss Dunbar used to sell ice creams and lemonade and stuff like that. So it was very popular. But one of the things she did do, and I was explaining to my grandson, Harris, the other day, was that the Pebbly Beach, the Shingly Beach, Kingston, has loads of semi-precious stones that have come from erosion further up the Spey Valley, by the Spey. And she had, Miss Dunbar had a hobby. And she said in one occasion, she said, come with me and we'll walk up the beach. So we walked up the beach and I'm saying, what is it you're looking for? She said, I'm looking for carnelian, semi-precious stone. And I said, oh, God's sake, how can you find a piece of carnelian on a beach like this? It's absolutely covered in pebbles and shingle. She said, come with me and I'll show you how to do it. So we were walking west towards Lossiemouth and there was shingle and patches of sand. And she said, you see the sand? There it is. I said, yeah, it's getting low in the sky. She said, right. You look at the shingle. And she said, carnelian has a property that allows the sun's rays to come through it. And you see a pink light. She said, it's not very bright, but you can pick them up, when you're used to the light, you know, and how dim it is. So she picked up a couple of these little pebbles and said, look, there's a carnelian and there's a carnelian. So we took back to the shop. She said, now what I do is this. So she had one of these, machines on her counter that you put water and some abrasive material and you chuck it in and switch it on and leave it for a week. And that's what she used to do. And she used to get these lovely little carnelian, semi-precious gem. And then her hobby was, especially in the winter, was to get a handful of these and make jewelry, earrings and such like bangles. So I was saying to my grandson, what about getting one of those for you and all the flinty bits we have in Oxfordshire, you know, if they're suitable. You know, like gravel on a drive where you get some lovely little pieces. Why don't we do that? So he's quite keen on that. Yeah, so that was another facet, really.
Oh, it's lovely, Dad. And you were one of four.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, another thing I suppose that was different back then is that there would have been a lot of children in that village.
Yeah.
You drive through Kingston now and it's like many coastal villages now, you know, people work in other towns or cities and, you know, there aren't as so many children And if there are, they have to go further afield to go to school because all the little schools have closed down.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. And there were so many children in the village there. And because there was no entertainment inside, they all spilled out into the village, dogs, children, and they would sort of meet up and say, oh, what can we do today? And there were games like kick the can and skipping the girls used to do and all sorts of weird and wonderful games. And then, especially in the summer, as you said earlier, it's very light until late in Scotland, that part of Scotland. So we used to stay out until 11 o'clock at night, probably, and go to the beach. And one of the birds I neglected to mention were the pied wagtails. There were pied wagtails all along the beach where branches had been thrown up on the beach, and where tin cans were rusting and just lying there, and they had colonized loads of these tin cans, and they made their nests in there and lived on the little insects and so on the beach. But the prize when looking for tin cans and nests was to find Brasso tins. Remember Brasso, Jane?
Yeah.
Brasso was a Polish, well. It had a little screw job that was usually difficult to undo. So we used to go and look for these because one of the great excitement we used to have was on the seashore, beside the estuary of Spey, we used to get loads and loads of timber and anything else flammable and heap it up to make a bonfire. And then we would chuck in as many Brasso tins as we could, light it, and then scupper. We would run like hell away from the blast because these Brasso tins, because they were tightly closed, and because of the fumes, some kind of spirit they had inside, they used to go off like a mortar bomb. So as you ran back to the village, you'd hear these kind of bang, and then as the bonfire crept through the flammable stuff, you'd get another one, and two would go off. That
then was great fun. Then you'd go home, and your mum would say, "Oh, Ian."
Oh, yeah, and you've been, shouldn't have done that, and disturbed the neighbour. Yeah, no, that was a different life. But so, Jenny will, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it's really lovely hearing about your early life because it's, you know, it's a part of your life that the only way that I can delve into it is you reliving it by telling me and also other people that are interested. And I know a lot of people have been listening to these podcasts and are asking us to do them a bit more regularly. So I think we need to make a commitment to do at least one every month.
Yes, that'd be good. And I think it, like you were saying, memories like that. I mean, we probably some of our relatives, like Uncle John, who died a few years ago, aged 100. I mean, he was he remembered so much about what went on in the early 1900s. So maybe we'll start something and get, it would be nice to do things like that, encourage people to look at nature, for example, and more deeply, but also to look back on their early years. See what relevance there is to life in a pandemic like this, with all the pressures that people have, probably particularly the young people, to keep afloat and just feel mentally healthy.
But yeah, the other thing, I think, just to, before we say cheerio, Dad, I think the other thing with this podcast is to encourage other people to do this, to speak to their mums and dads, and to record it, even if you don't put it out on a podcast.
It's
so important, isn't it, to know your parents' history, really, you know, and to it's little things. It's not just the big things. You know, you've lived a very rich life all over the world. But these little things, these early parts of your life, help to fill in parts of the jigsaw that were before my time, about what has made you who you are, why are you so passionate about the things that you are. And listening to you today has given me such a you know, it's a richer insight into you and your you know, and your triggers, I suppose.
An exciting thing is, Jane, we can go and visit things.
Exactly. Well, we have recently, haven't we? When you were last up, we did go and visit Kingston, and some of your old friends are still there, which is really nice to be able to go and visit them.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll do that. We'll make a plan for that when we're released from our bondage at the moment. Pandemic.
Exactly. But, seems to be going on for an eternity, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But we'll get through it, won't we? Everybody just think, well, we can do.
I mean, I think a lot during the pandemic, a lot of people are doing things wouldn't otherwise have done. And that's.
I agree, Dad. Yeah. I agree. Well, we probably, I think we did start this just before the pandemic, but not long before.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, right. Well, we're off now for Christmas.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm off for Christmas. So let's do another couple of podcasts over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all right, good. Dad. So you'll be off for a cup of coffee and a mince pie now, no doubt.
Have a coffee and a mince pie, and also a drop of Balvenie, which you sent me. Thank you very much. The Caribbean cask Balvenie, 14 years old.
Oh, you'll like that. Just don't drink it all at once, Dad, otherwise you won't be recording anything.
No, that's for sure. Right, Jenny, love you, and we'll talk probably Christmas Day.
Yeah, love you, Dad.
Yeah, love you too. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.